The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
You think that you can come here and pretend to be holy?
I'm starting to think that you're not human.
You seem to be the real deal. No wonder they don't like you.
We will demand Patriarch Sofronie to be removed and place you in his position.
I understand why the people of Egypt love you. We had you here for a short time and you've performed miracles.
You're a holy man, Your Grace. I lost my eyesight due to illness when I was very little. There is so much light in your presence.
We feel that you don't exercise enough authority.
A healthy balance between kindness and authority is best.
Where is the evidence of my crime? An accusation that condemns me to a moral death.
If it had been done to me, what has been done to you, I would not go to church anymore.
Holy man of God, will you please pray for me?
The position of power is like a cancer. It eats at you slowly.
I wish I would have faith.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, thanks for being here with me. That audio you just heard there was from a trailer. And there's a new movie out, and I want to get you plugged in. I normally don't talk movies, because not everybody goes to see them, not everybody's interested. I don't talk TV shows for the most part, but this is Lent, and I think today we need some inspiration. You know, we need some hope. We need some goodness, right? Come Easter time, there's a ton of movies, right? In fact, you always see the attack on the faith. There's the ossuary of this, and you know, the fact that Mary Magdalene was married to Jesus, that, and that Christ didn't rise because we found this, and you know, the shrouds are fake. And I mean, they love to sow doubt. Come Easter time, there are some good Easter movies. You have resurrection movies and things too, but you can see how Satan hates the resurrection, right? I think Lent is such a unique time. And if you're looking for something spiritual to watch, then we're going to get you plugged in to Man of God. It's the story of a humble priest who would come to be venerated by the Eastern Orthodox Church as Saint Nectarius of Aegina. It's a true story. It is. And I'll share a little bit of it with you. But before I do, the reason I'm talking about it today is my producer Maggie went and saw it. And she told me a great story last night. She's true. We really should talk. We should get people plugged into this. She says, I think they'll find a lot of merit. She says, I really was touched by it. And Maggie, let me open your mic. And just for a moment, I mean, this is a movie that you were really impacted by. Share a little bit about it, if you could, and why you think it's so worth seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. I found out that it was playing at one of the theaters just down the street from us. So I walked down there. I was blown away. I actually ended up having to go to the Blessed Sacrament after watching it, and just I actually just cried for a bit because it was It was so moving. This was a humble priest who preferred to do the everyday life of the common man and be around those people instead of being promoted to positions of power, even though everyone around him wanted him to go to those positions of power because they thought he would be such a good patriarch, and and he kept denying himself that because he preferred the humble life. So there was this great, you know, you and I were talking about penance a lot outside of the show the other day.
Yeah, because we've been talking a lot about that on the air. We need to do more of prayer and penance and sacrifice. And you shared with me a great story. It inspired me. You got to share that.
Yeah, there's this great point in the movie where Nectarios has become a part of a school, and he oversees a number of boys that are being educated there. Some of them get into a fight and no one's really fessing up to what happened, and they're brought to his office and he says, okay, give me your account and give me your account, and all the boys go through their version of what happened, and he says, okay, well, it looks like I have no choice but to punish myself.
Wow.
Cook, let the cook know I will not be eating for the next 3 days. And so then you see the next scene, the boys are at dinner and everyone is chowing down. And the one who you suspect was probably lying looks at his bowl and just pushes it. You know, he can't eat it.
Wow.
And it just shows you that sometimes you don't have to inflict things on others. That if you do that prayer and penance yourself in their honor, it might change their life.
Wow. What a profound example.
Yeah.
You struck, I'm going to do penance. Mm-hmm. For you. It's like, mm-hmm. wow. And how that convicted the heart of the other person. Mm-hmm. I love it. And maybe somebody has wounded you. Maybe somebody's done you wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you should pray for that person. Maybe do fasting or sacrifice on their behalf and watch how God takes that gift of your generosity and uses it in them. It's a great movie. The movie is called Man of God. The writer director is Yelena Popovich. And I've invited her to join us today. All right. She's a Serbian-American actress. She's a writer, director, producer. And she wrote and directed Man of God. So we'll check it out. She joins us today. Hey, Yelena, thanks for being with us. Good to have you with us. Or Yelena, I should say.
Thank you so much for having me. I was moved by what you were saying. Thank you for such kind words about my film.
Well, the credit goes to you because you wrote that, and Maggie, as you heard, went and cried. She had to go before the Blessed Sacrament. So God's using your gifts in a powerful way. To be honest with you, I didn't know a whole lot about this great saint, Saint Nectarius. For those who are listening, fill them in on his life and maybe his story and why this movie, of course, will be such a blessing this time of year.
Well, to be honest with you, I found out about him myself in 2012 when I just read a book about him. And why, I would just quickly say something. It was very personal to me because I had a father who was also prosecuted for the righteousness' sake.
Oh, wow.
And I witnessed somebody refuse to basically move ahead in life, mm-hmm. Over his morals and ethics. And he was even, there were six witnesses brought to the stand, false witnesses, get rid of him. Because he was a man who wouldn't want to abuse people underneath him and move ahead in an unethical way. So when my father passed away, it was a year after him passing away that I was in Serbia. I didn't see him for 10 years. I couldn't even go to his funeral. And now I'm at the Mass, and after the Mass, I go and I buy the book about him because I heard about him. So when I read the story of this incredible priest, who was basically slandered and prosecuted throughout his whole life, and just because he was righteous, and how he chose, basically because of his incredible faith, he had so much faith in God and so much love for Christ that he lived by what he preached, and that's why people around him didn't like him. Because they were afraid that he was going to become a patriarch, and they didn't want somebody who really cared for people, who was willing to sacrifice himself. Because if he was around them, it would make them, basically they would be reminded that if they were not doing what they were preaching, they were doing something wrong, so they had to get rid of him. So he ended up getting exiled from Egypt. He was metropolitan, about to become a patriarch. He ended up getting exiled. He goes to Athens, and the slander keeps following him until the end of his life because they actually have to keep slandering him in order to prevent him to ever become a patriarch, even though that's the last thing he ever wanted.
Yeah.
And just the way he dealt with this constant abuse and shame until the end of his life, and basically I've experienced that through my father, some of it I've experienced myself. Wow. Faith has played an incredible part in my life.
Wow.
I must say that thanks to God, I'm still here. I'm alive. I'm still fighting.
Wow.
I know what it means to fall down and get up, never give up. And that was also life of Saint Nectarius. I'm not comparing myself. I'm not a saint, but I understand to a degree what he's been through. And because of such a personal understanding, I decided, if God willing, I was praying about this, if I was given a chance to make this movie, I knew that I would be able to put myself in the film and my personal experience, mm-hmm. and therefore be able to affect people with this incredible story and hopefully heal them in some ways, because I know we all need God in our lives. And I know you said something earlier, faith has been attacked. And that's such a shame, because without God, without love, without peace, we are not alive. You know, we suffer. People are really suffering. And I think more than ever nowadays, people are turning to light, even though they're just surrounded with so much darkness.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
There is really no way out. The only way out is the peace in the heart. And without peace in the heart, there is no peace in the family. There is no peace in the world.
Amen to that. It begins there. You're right. It begins in the heart. It ripples to the community and then to the world at large. Yelena, I love the stories of men like this, men of great sacrifice and penance and prayer and walk closely to the Lord. I believe in the communion of saints. I believe they intercede for us. We see the fruit of the intercession of the saints many times. My understanding is there have been a lot of miracles associated with him. He's known as a wonder worker. Maybe you can share a little bit of the power and the efficacy of his intercession. What kind of miracles have taken place for him, and why did he get that title, wonder worker?
Well, he is actually known as a saint of a cancer.
He passed
away of prostate cancer.
Oh, wow.
Yes, and he and there have been like thousands of miracles that have happened. He has healed so many people from cancer. I've actually witnessed one that I personally have indirectly witnessed was when my younger son Nikolai, who was going to preschool in Los Angeles, prior to us moving to Greece. When we moved to Greece, he stayed in touch with his teacher, Debbie, because he loved her so much. So we would call Debbie once a month just to say hello to her, and she would be always happy. One day we called the preschool, Montessori, it was in Los Angeles, in Culver City area, and they told me that Debbie was in coma and that she had multiple tumors and they were just waiting for her to pass away. And we couldn't believe what we heard. So as I was working on this film, and I knew the power of the prayers of St. Nectarius and him healing cancer, I told Nikolai, let's go to the church of St. Nectarius and go and pray. We went and prayed. I asked Nikolai to kneel in front of his icon and for him to do a prayer. As you know, a child is very pure, and prayers of children are, I think, God hears everybody, but the pure kid is, you know, something that is special, I think. So we both prayed, and I didn't obviously call the next day. I just left it at that. I had hoped that she will get better. It was a sad experience to even hear that she was in such condition. So about 3 weeks later, out of curiosity, I called again, or a month later, something like that. And I called the not her cell phone, but the school, Montessori. And she answers, and she says to me, Yelena, I'm a miracle, Yelena. You don't understand. I said, Debbie, you know, and she says, there are no tumors. They don't understand. And this is something that I have personally seen, just being like, 5,000 miles away from a prayer. And then 2 years later, when I visited Los Angeles, I brought her an oil that, you know, burns in Aegina, where he's Aegina, say it in English, where his holy relics are there, which is an hour here from Athens. And I told her what happened, and gave her the oil. And she said, "Well, listen, I still have some. Apparently, the tumors are not any more dangerous, but there are some." And I told her, "Just anoint yourself every evening." I gave her the oil. So, I know countless miracles of this miraculous saint. And I think God has really glorified him, because he has suffered so much, and he had that heart to forgive and to love even his enemies. And that's something, obviously, that the Lord has a lot of respect for.
You know, I'm going to have to introduce him to my producer, Tom. He's the other producer on the show here. And he's out. And the reason I bring up his name to you, Yelena, is because his daughter just went through a very serious surgery. She had a brain. She had tumors in the brain. She had a melanoma. And they had to do surgery there, and it's moved to the lymph system, which is really concerning. Cancer can be deadly, but we've seen miracles happen all the time with it. We pray the Chapel of Divine Mercy here. We get report after report of it. We know St. Peregrine, but as I said, God often puts saints into our lives, and I knew nothing about this wonderful saint until you joined us today. And the fact that he's known as a cancer saint, I know there's a lot of people listening right now who'd like to learn more about him. I know they can see your movie, so let's do two things. How can they see the movie? And then two, how can they learn more about St. Nectarius?
Well, they can see a movie if they go to fathomevents.com or just type in Men of God, one or the other, and the film will be playing on 800 screens across the nation. That's wow. About 46 states, 178 cities. So if you type in Men of God and you go to their page, and it says buy a ticket, and you can put a zip code, and it will show you the theaters are all around. You know, wow. It's pretty easily accessible. And it's playing at 7 p.m. And speaking of saints, I actually, as you can imagine, I've experienced more miracles during shooting of the film than what we decided to put in the movie, to
wow.
be honest.
Wow.
And I'm as an added value to the film, I was asked by our distributor, because I guess they do that. One Fathom Events, they usually do inspirational films, and when they release them, they asked us to shoot 10 minutes of something of like added value, maybe behind the scenes. So I decided to narrate an amazing miracle that Archangel Michael did for us during the shooting of the film.
Well, you got to share some of that. Can you share that?
If people, can I share that? Okay, well, basically what happened was we were, as you can imagine, in independent filmmaking, plus it was during the pandemic, we were so pressed with time, with finance, with everything, that we couldn't really afford not having a few days of shooting or moving things around. The whole production would have fallen apart. It was that wow. intense. So we basically, there was a day when there was this hurricane that was coming from Italy after Greece, and they wanted us to stop shooting for 2-3 days, which would have caused a huge problem. And I just don't want to give the whole thing away, but basically it mm-hmm. just fell. That day fell on the miracle that we celebrate. In Serbia, we celebrated a little different date, but it was 19th of September. And when I found out it was in the day of miracle of Archangel Michael, I said to everybody, no, we're going to shoot. Let's not cancel the crew. Everybody thought I was crazy, of course. They thought we're going to just have a day of a disaster. No one's going to show up. We're going to lose the money for that day. We have to pay everybody. Well, basically what happened was that for the 6 hours when we were shooting, there was not a drop of rain. There was no wind. We're wow. in the perimeter of half a kilometer. It was raining everywhere.
Wow. Well, you know, God is a God of miracles. I love it. No, I love it.
So we had a lot of those while we were shooting. I can say glory to God. Thank God for this. I've seen it, and I couldn't do this, yeah. believe me, without help of God and His Blessed Mother, and no, it would never happen.
Well, I love it. I've not seen the movie yet. Maggie has seen it, and I'm going to maybe try to sneak out and take a sneak peek at it as well. It's called Man of God. You can do a search for it, find out where it is, and learn more about the saints.
Saint Nectarius of Egina, you can type, I mean, it's if you just type in Saint Nectarius of Egina, he actually wrote also beautiful books. He's a great writer. I think it's very contemporary, great for our times, easy to understand, and obviously to pray to him for any kind of ailment or disease. He's been really incredible and very present.
Well, Yelena, apparently he's chosen you to help spread his message. You know, I often turn to the blesseds, the venerables, and of course to these great saints. So you're doing a wonderful work using the big screen to tell his story. I know it'll inspire many people. And I'm grateful for you here on the air with us. You know, we blanket about 250 million households across the continental U.S. here, and we're heard around the world via the Internet. So I know you've introduced him to a lot of souls. And if those miracles come in, let us know, okay, everyone? You can write to us, and we'll give credit to St. Nectarius. Am I saying that right? Nectarius.
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 Yes.
There you go. Hey, thank you, Yelena. Great to have you here. I appreciate you spending time with me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Again, check out the movie. Look, this is a new saint to me, but I love it. I love what he represents, the life he lived, the fruit that he is now bearing, interceding from the other side. The movie's called Man of God. It's the story of a humble priest who became venerated by the Eastern Orthodox Church, and who today I know will intercede for you. So check it out, all right? When we return, I'll change gears. I want to bring you up to something I've been following. It's a call for greater prayer. Will we see the possible use of nuclear weapons? You know, there are experts that say a new generation of nuclear weapons may make the prospect of a nuclear strike less implausible than it once was. I'll tell you why. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
There are 15,000 nuclear weapons on the planet, and the 9 nuclear weapon states are in conflict with each other. The United States and North Korea, NATO and Russia, India and Pakistan. We're just one misunderstanding, one mistake, or one fanatic politician away from a nuclear conflict. In the Second World War, fleets of hundreds or even 1,000 airplanes were used to bomb a single city. But with the invention of the atomic bomb, only one airplane and one bomb was needed. The Enola Gay carried one atomic bomb with the power of 15,000 tons of TNT. And when it dropped that bomb on Hiroshima, Japan, 100,000 people died. Over time, even more powerful bombs were built, hydrogen bombs. This 1960s airplane carried 5 hydrogen bombs and had the power of 500 Hiroshima bombs. And of course, the United States and Russia don't just use airplanes. They have intercontinental ballistic missiles with hydrogen bombs on them. And they have nuclear submarines with missiles. A single Trident missile submarine can carry 100 hydrogen bombs with the explosive power of 1,000 Hiroshima bombs.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
That was a TED Talk. That was atmospheric scientist Brian Toon. He was talking about the state of nuclear weapons in the world today. And just to maybe give you a little perspective on them and where we are right now, it's frightening. Experts say that there is now a new generation of nuclear arms that may make the prospect of nuclear strikes less implausible. And it raises fear that Vladimir Putin might deploy them in or around Ukraine. Just to give you some perspective, have you ever seen the bombing of Hiroshima? Have you seen what they happened in Nagasaki? You saw the devastation of that bomb that was dropped by the Enola Gay, right? Horrible. It was unbelievable. That was an atomic bomb. What happened since, in the years that followed, we've created behemoths, right? What we've developed during the Cold War, during this atomic race, it dwarfed that atomic bomb that destroyed Hiroshima, Washington, our own country's one of the biggest tests we've ever had. It was 1,000 times larger than Hiroshima. 1,000 times. Think about how big of a weapon that would be, and what a territory, the devastation, the radiation that would follow. You think that's big? Moscow has bombs 3,000 times as powerful. Think about that. 3,000 times as powerful as the atomic bomb that we dropped on Hiroshima. So on both sides, the reason to get more powerful, bigger weapons was MAD, right? Mutual assured destruction. The idea was to deter strikes with threats of vast retaliation. So if Russia was to fire one or we were to fire one, it would be the end of the world as we know it, or at least the end of those countries as we know it. The psychological bar was so high that nuclear strikes became unthinkable. They should be unthinkable, right? Who in their right mind? We should not have nuclear weapons today. We should not have them. So both Russia and the U.S., they had this nuclear arms race. And since those weapons became so strong, they decided to create much less destructive bombs. And so now we have bombs, not enough to destroy the planet. Not that we don't still have those. We do. But we've got weapons. They're just fractions of what happened at Hiroshima. Their force, the use might be maybe a little less frightening, and some are saying maybe a little bit more thinkable. I don't think we should use nuclear weapon, period, right? We shouldn't use nuclear weapons at all. Concern about the smaller arms has soared, and Vladimir Putin, has threatened, consequences never before seen. And I wonder if we're going to see that. If he gets pushed into a corner, will we see Vladimir Putin using atomic weaponry. I don't know, but it is a stark reminder, really, if you think about it, of where we are right now. You know, do you remember when the president, I think it was this past Sunday, he ordered the Kremlin to kickstart their nuclear war evacuation drills in an apparent threat, I think, to the West and to the alliance. Putin had put these doomsday plans on standby. A telegram channel linked with the Russian presidency said that there were several disturbing claims, you know, and Putin then ordered military commanders and top advisors to get ready for drills of the so-called Flying Kremlins. These are planes that replaced previous planes, and they could go ahead and they could stay in the air for a very long time if there was a nuclear war. So he put all, he put his forces on special combat readiness earlier, and he warned the world. He warned the U.S., he warned the EU, he warned allied nations. He said to NATO that you will experience, if you interfere with us, consequences that you have never experienced in your history. And I've talked about this in the past. I'm not here to scare you. That doesn't say cyber attacks. We've experienced those. I think he was referring to his nuclear weapons. Several claims emerged, you know, inking war to, you know, Russian leaders' mental states. People wondered how he is. Oh, does he have an, you know, is he sick? Is it the result of COVID? I don't think so. I think Vladimir Putin is saying to the world, don't push me in a corner, because if you do, this is what's going to happen. And Russia did say we'd only use nuclear weapons in the context of the Ukraine conflict if it was facing an existential threat, right? That's what the Vatican spokesperson says. He says, we have a concept of domestic security, and it's public. You can read the reasons for nuclear arms to be used. So if it's an existential threat to our country, then it will be used in accordance with that concept. My question is, how much do we believe them? They told the world also, we're just doing drills. We're not going to invade. Don't worry. No, no, no. They weren't doing drills. We knew exactly what they were doing. I'm joined right now by Dr. Peter Pry. This is a man who you've heard on this program many times. We talked about EMPs. We've talked about nuclear weapons. We've talked about what it would do to the power grid and much more. And I'm grateful to have him, especially today. And the reason I tell you that, he's been in such high demand today that his cell phone's about to die. And he's done interview after interview after interview, because every mainstream media, every mainstream outlet is well aware of this threat and what it could possibly present. And Dr. Pry, of course, executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. Dr. Pry, I'm grateful. I know how tired you must be. You've been on the phone all day doing interviews. Thanks for being with us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, you know, let's get into it. You and I have spoken about EMPs. We've talked about the threat of what would happen if a high-altitude nuclear weapon was to go off. I want to jump right to Russia, because I'm sure this is what everyone's been talking to you about today, too. The Russian spokesperson says that, hey, it's possible that they could use these. They have a criteria they laid out as to what would, you know, what those circumstances would be. We also have low-yield nuclear weapons right now. I'm going to throw you the softball here, and I just want you to lay it out for us. What kind of threat is Russia making? How real is that threat? And what would we be likely to see?
Well, although they haven't described it as such, they're postured to make a surprise nuclear attack. That is almost certainly, you know, what Vladimir Putin meant when he said he was putting his forces on a special combat alert and then went down into his deep underground bunker and has disappeared from the scene. Mm-hmm. These deep underground facilities are hundreds of meters deep in solid granite. There's hundreds of them in Russia for political military leadership. Some of them are like small cities and can accommodate up to 30,000 people.
Wow.
Also, there are reports that their elites have been flying out to the Ural Mountains, where they also have city-sized deep underground facilities impervious to nuclear attack. There's a general staff command post at Kozvinsky Mountain that the Russians built. This is built after the Cold War. And another one at Yamantau Mountain that is like the size of a small city impervious to nuclear attack underground. The Russians have done this because they think, unlike us, they think you can fight and win a nuclear war. And I think they're right if you have postured yourself to survive and postured yourself to launch a surprise attack that would disarm your adversaries. The Biden administration has been providing false assurance through the intelligence community that Putin is just bluffing and that there's really not a nuclear threat. He's just engaged in nuclear saber rattling. I think they're saying that for political reasons, because the president doesn't want to explain what vital national interest the U.S. has in Ukraine that's so important that it's worth risking NATO and the United States, worth risking our existence in a nuclear war with Russia. They have testified, for example, that they have seen no evidence of Russia mobilizing its forces. You know, and that is, in effect, either a lie or they have forgotten how to do their business. You know, because the Russian strategic posture is completely different from the U.S. strategic posture. Yes, both sides have submarines. Both sides have intercontinental ballistic missiles. Both sides have bombers. But the way the Russians posture these forces is very different from ours. Our triad is postured to deter nuclear war. It's postured for transparency and what we call crisis stability, so that if we get in a conflict, you know, or if there's a crisis that could escalate to the nuclear level, our adversaries can see our forces are not mobilizing for nuclear war. Our forces are much more visible than the Russians. Most of our weapons are on ballistic missile submarines and on bombers. Those are not ready to go in a few moments' notice. Our submarines have to be sent to sea. The bad guys can see that. It takes 3 days to mobilize our bombers. The bad guys can see that. Mm-hmm. Even our emergency action messages, if we were going to use the submarines on patrol, the few that we have on patrol, normally there's only about four of them, we have to send out TACAMO aircraft. Normally they're parked at Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma, and they have to fly out over the Atlantic and Pacific to raise what it's called a bell ringer so that our submarines can surface to get emergency action messages or come near the surface to get emergency action messages. And the bad guys can see that. And that is all deliberately visible and transparent. So the bad guys in the middle of a crisis will know we're not getting ready to launch a surprise nuclear attack against them. We do have the smallest number of our weapons are on our ICBMs. These are ready to go in a few minutes, but each one is only loaded with a single warhead. So that's not really a good first strike weapon, because they're not MIRV. They don't have multiple warheads, which would enable an ICBM to take out many targets. With the Russians, it's just the opposite. The difference in our strategic postures is like night and day. Most of Russia's warheads are on ICBMs. Those are ready to be launched in a few minutes. All Putin has to do is give the order and to do it. So when Putin makes a threat, it ought not to be dismissed as just bluffing or saber rattling. He's mm-hmm. got the capability to deliver on that threat. And going down into a bunker, that is one of the most important indicators that he's serious about that threat. And the fact that there's a major war in Europe with the two nuclear superpowers involved is another huge strategic warning indicator. Historically, everybody has agreed that the possibility of a nuclear war gets up when that circumstance exists, and it exists now. And last, and then I'll let you get a word in edgewise, just as you correctly noted that the Russians were saying they were doing an exercise with forces that were actually posturing themselves, being mobilized to invade Ukraine, and that's what happened. They did invade Ukraine, right. And Putin was lying. It wasn't an exercise. He was getting ready to invade. Mm-hmm. At the same time, before he invaded Ukraine, there was a major all-nuclear forces exercise called Thunder, or Grom in Russian. We talked about this on your show, where they actually launched, you know, dummy warheads into the Arctic Ocean, you know, uncomfortably close to NATO Europe, which is a highly unusual thing for them to do. And just as they mobilized their conventional forces for the invasion of Ukraine through the guise of an exercise, we have right in front of us a major strategic forces exercise that was probably a guise for mobilizing their nuclear forces as well, so that they can be better positioned to do a surprise attack. And that's, you know, that's the administration doesn't want to admit that. They want everybody to ignore that. It's because it puts them in a, they don't want to have to admit that they've committed their Ukraine policy has brought us to this verge of catastrophe that is far worse than the humiliation recently suffered in Afghanistan.
Yeah. So, Doctor, you know, two things. I mean, with the weapons, when you deal with the gravity and the size of some of these nuclear weapons, I mean, we of course have mad, mutually assured destruction, and we know that there could be retaliation as a result of that. I don't know if Vladimir Putin, would he go that far to try to wipe the United States off the face of the map? I'm thinking, and here's what some pundits have said, they postured that perhaps he'll use a low-yield nuclear weapon, fire it into an empty space somewhere in Ukraine, just to warn the world that I have these and I'm not afraid to use them. Would he be more apt to use a low-yield nuclear weapon? Of course, I'm sure that would probably get the world's attention and maybe even involved, but which of those two scenarios do you think is more probable?
Oh, I think it's more likely the scenario that you just described, using a low-yield, one of their advanced technology tactical nuclear weapons, possibly in a battlefield in Ukraine, or doing a simulated, doing an EMP attack over the North or South Pole, something that doesn't harm anybody, but demonstrates their resolve and their willingness, you know, to use nuclear weapons. And I think that they're right. It's called an escalate to de-escalate strategy, yes. Or you might all might the Russian version of shock and awe using nuclear weapons,
right.
Because they know the West is so fearful of nuclear war, you know, that would be so sobering to us. And I think that the gamble on their part, it wouldn't be much of a gamble. I think the West, Washington, all the European NATO allies, you know, would be eager to find an off ramp for Russia and for ourselves to get out of the situation, you know, in order to avoid a nuclear conflict. But it might not stop there. We mustn't, you know, the Russians are extremely paranoid. I'm sure there's a great debate going on between those who would follow the escalate to de-escalate strategy, which is what their doctrine is. But they might depart from their doctrine and might conclude, look, if we do this, we're risking the United States getting involved with either tactical nuclear strikes. I wrote a whole article describing how you could escalate, you know, from the small, low-scale use to tactical nuclear weapons in the theater. They might say, well, we've got to disarm NATO Europe, so make strikes against the NATO European tactical nuclear weapons to eliminate those. And others would say, look, you can't contain a nuclear war. We've got the advantage. We have the capability to launch a surprise attack and do a nuclear Pearl Harbor. Let's go the whole way. And especially if it's an existential threat, I think what they would do depends critically upon what the actual situation is in Ukraine. If what we're hearing every night on the news is true, and the Russians are bogged down or potentially losing the war in Ukraine, and if we listen to the chicken hawks in Washington, the people who want to jump into the war in Ukraine and deliver a decisive defeat to Russia, and if it's true that that means that Vladimir Putin could fall from power, which means his death at the hands of his political enemies and the death of his elites who surround him, and that's an existential threat, of course, this dictator and rogue and, you know, person who is, you know, in the pattern of Stalin, would certainly gamble the dice, roll the dice, and it's not much of a gamble, given that we have not mobilized our forces to make them survivable against the surprise attack under President Biden. It's the first time we've left our forces at DEFCON 5, the lowest readiness level, despite clear evidence of the Russians mobilizing themselves. So if what is being said on TV is true and the Russians are losing Ukraine and Putin could fall from power and we want to make him a war criminal and we would like to see him killed by his own people, and if that is all true, it greatly increased the possibility, not of the small nuclear scenario, but the big nuclear scenario.
Yeah.
If Putin, on the other hand, if we're wrong, and we could be wrong, here I will make myself very unpopular, because I'm probably the only one that's going to say that.
Well,
say this. But I think Doctor, wrong.
Hold that thought, okay, because I got to take a short break.
Okay.
When we come back, you can share that with all of us. And if you want to join us, my guest today, Dr. Peter Pry, Executive Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. We only have a few minutes with him. The number is 888-914-9149 if you want to get in. Moscow has warned the U.S. and NATO, look, you supply Ukraine with fighter jets, it could escalate and expand the war, potentially putting Russia in direct confrontation with nuclear-armed rivals. Stay with me. Relevant Radio runs on horsepower, your horsepower.
Donate any vehicle and keep your station running. Join in with thousands of other listeners who have given their unused vehicles at relevantradio.com/car.
Drew Mariani is here for you on Relevant Radio.
Good to be with you today. Taking a look at developing news coming out of Russia and Ukraine and just raising some questions, trying to look at it and explore them with an expert today. How real is the threat of a nuclear exchange? We're talking about low-yield nuclear weapons, which could possibly be used on the battlefield. Look, Vladimir Putin right now, Russia is bombing civilian centers. What would stop him? If you can shoot at hospitals, if you can shoot at maternity wards, if you can shoot at apartment buildings, why not use a low-yield nuclear weapon? They're a fraction of what the Hiroshima bomb was that we dropped. But then the other side of that spectrum is, what is to stop Vladimir Putin if he thinks he's lost, to take out his biggest foe, the United States or its NATO allies or whoever he decides to strike? He could do so. My guest today, Dr. Peter Pry, who's the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security, says already Vladimir Putin has gone into bunkers. There are underground cities that have been developed well below the surface of the earth and granted, built specifically to survive nuclear bomb blasts that could house up to 30,000 people. What kind of intelligence do we have? How real is this? And again, I don't want to scare anyone. I just want to explore the possibility of it. And doctor, you were about to share with me when we went to break something you said would probably make you sound very unpopular. I'll let you pick it back up.
Okay. We assume that we've got perfect intelligence on what's going on in Ukraine and that the Russians are bogged down. They're losing the war. And therefore there's an elevated threat of nuclear use by the Russians because of desperation by a desperate Putin. I would ask all listeners to suspend judgment because we don't really know what's happening on the battlefield of Ukraine. The fog of war is very thick. Don't forget, just a few months ago, we suffered the humiliation of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And we had our best intelligence. Our own army was on the ground. We'd been there for years, and we were assured that we wouldn't suffer a humiliating withdrawal or defeat in Afghanistan, and we could probably prop up a friendly government in Afghanistan that would last at least for a while. And all of that turned out to not be true because our intelligence people didn't understand the reality of what was happening on the ground. Now, we don't have our own troops in Ukraine. Almost everything we know about the Ukraine war is coming from the Ukrainian government. And the Ukrainian government has an interest in convincing us that they're winning, that the Russians are bogged down, that this is a great opportunity for the American chicken hawks like Senator Graham to jump into the war and send our boys into Ukraine and put up no-fly zones that will bring us in direct confrontation with Russia. And almost everybody in both the Democrat and Republican Party seems eager to do that, to deliver the killing blow to punish Putin for his aggression. What if they're all wrong? And the Biden administration is the other source of our information, and they have an interest in trying to make the Russians look like they are losing that war in Ukraine because they don't want the narrative to be about how Biden drew a line in the sand, dared Putin across it, and Putin sent his tanks across,
right,
and destroyed Biden's and America's credibility so that we are pursuing a strategy of fighting to the death of the last brave Ukrainian.
Yeah.
And imposing basically pretty harmless economic sanctions. Economic sanctions that were promised are going to be really tough, but let's face it, sanctions have never stopped the bad guys or really hurt them. It's just a way for our leaders to look tough.
So
I think, and I'm not saying that this is likely, okay, or is the truth. I'm just saying we don't know what the truth is on the battlefield. Maybe we won't know for years after the Ukrainian war is over, but I can think of several other scenarios where the Russians aren't losing.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of the Battle of Austerlitz in 1805, which was Napoleon's greatest victory, carefully studied by the Russian general staff, where Napoleon pretended he was losing the Battle of Austerlitz. He put his forces on the worst ground. He had French troops retreat in the face of Russian divisions and lured the Austrians and the Russians into attacking him. And then he hammered them with divisions that he had hidden on the battlefield, destroyed their armies, and it gave him the domination of Europe for the next decade.
Yeah, it's
what
true.
If Russia wants the U.S. and NATO to intervene in Ukraine? It certainly seems like he and the Russian army are behaving in a very provocative way, calculated to lure us into intervening in Ukraine. There's a few things that Americans find more intolerant than an evil dictator who at the same time is cruel and inhuman and at the same time not very competent militarily and isn't 10 feet tall anymore.
Yep.
You know, why not go in?
That's
and
such
him,
a great
kick him if we can.
Theory. That's Pardon? A that is such a great theory. It looks
he's
so true. And he's doing things that
nuclear weapons.
And he's doing things, Doctor, that clearly, you know, are war crimes. So you can see there's a great there's a bipartisan desire right now to help Ukraine, and I'm sure that they would be willing to also support him. Let me do this, support the president if they decided to go in with NATO. I only have a couple minutes left. I want to grab a couple quick calls for you. So let me go to Reno, Nevada first. Anne Marie's been waiting. Want to sneak in her question. Hi, Anne Marie.
Hi, thank you for having me on the show.
You're welcome. Go right ahead, please.
Yes, I want to know, don't we have some real high-tech defense missiles for the United States? So that if they do try to launch them or head them towards the United States, we can, you know, intercede them or, you know, can divert them from us.
That's a good question. Missile defense. Thank you, Anne-Marie. We were limited on time, so I just want to let Dr. Pry respond to that. What do we have to...
We do have a national missile defense, thanks to George W. Bush, but it's extremely limited. You know, there are fewer than 100 missile interceptors. And they're not designed to intercept high-tech Russian or Chinese. They're not even really good against the North Korean missiles because we underestimated how sophisticated the North Korean missiles would be. They've been based on Chinese and Russian technology. So, yeah, we do have some national missile defenses, but it's very limited. It wouldn't be able to protect us from a massive first strike from Russia. The Russians would be able to brush those aside quite easily with an EMP attack.
All right, let's move along. Lewis is in Chicago. Lewis, good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. Yeah, I have a few statements. I think, number one, Putin would use the nuclear weapons. Number two, I think what we see on the news, especially the liberal news, is not all correct. I think it needs to be deciphered. Yes, there may be bombing in hospitals and children facilities. Yes, we know that. But I think we're not getting a whole picture. And then also, I also think when China makes the move, I think Putin could make the move. Because now here's the chaos, here's the confusion, and a perfect storm. We are a country in weakness.
All right, Lewis, thank you. To his point, we have about a minute left, and there's a lot of other people. They're concerned. We're concerned about Russia's nuclear weaponry, but let's bring China into the question, into the conversation too. What kind of threat are they nuclear in terms of a nuclear threat?
They will soon be a nuclear threat almost comparable to Russia because they're. Building those missile silos for the DF-41 ICBM out in the desert. And in a few years, they'll probably be able to field over 4,000 nuclear weapons, which would make them more powerful than the United States in terms of the numbers of nuclear weapons. So it would be twice as powerful as we are, at least. Currently, they have technological advantages over us in these advanced technology weapons that we don't have counterparts to, like super EMP weapons as well. One of the reasons Russia and China are strategic partners now is because Russia, for all of its other liabilities and disadvantages, it is the most advanced and strongest nuclear superpower in the world by far. The newspapers.
Dr. Pry, I've got to leave it right there. You know, I love having you on here, and we'll look forward to having you back again. Thank you for putting in such a long day. I'm Drew Mariani. Until next time, God bless.